thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.
Maneuverability was impossible at that point. The aircraft started to roll. I ordered the ejection. My navigator was first, and then I went off the airplane crashing less than a second. When we pulled the handle, we were at 30 feet.
Hello and welcome to episode 170 of the Fighter Pilot Podcast. I am your usual host, Vincent Aiello, call sign Jello, but this week we have a guest co-host helping out. He'll be along with his guest in a few minutes, and we'll talk more about that after some quick announcements and listener questions. Anyway, I hope you all are doing well and enjoying your last few days of spring as we get close to summer here. And last episode 169, boy, that was a big hit. You might have heard it. It featured my friend Brett Crozier, retired Navy captain, former helicopter pilot turned jet pilot. And then, of course, he was in the news back at the beginning of COVID. Well, we enjoyed that discussion, and I already read his book, Surf When You Can. Enjoyed that. I highly recommend you pick it up. And here's an interesting little tidbit for you. The former acting secretary of the Navy emailed the show right after that episode came out, and he offered to come on and tell his side of the story and suggested I read his book. So we'll see where that goes. But we had a pretty good back and forth email exchange. So anyway, big thanks to Brett Crozier for coming on the show and everybody who does, really. Now, that episode came out the same day my wife and I celebrated our silver anniversary. Those of you who follow the show on Instagram might have seen some photographs of our wedding 25 years ago on board USS John F. Kennedy. We got married on board an aircraft carrier right back at the One Wire, where I spent most of my time landing anyway. And it was a lot of fun. And for all of our friends and family and relatives who visited, many of them had never seen the ocean, let alone a big Navy aircraft carrier. So that was a lot of fun. And we were out for sushi celebrating our 25th, because last month we already went off to the Turks and Caicos for a bigger event. The FighterPilotPodcast.com website is different. If you go over to that now, you will see a new look. And it's not completely done. We were trying to get all our musings over there, but the glossary is up to date. And the shop page is coming along as well. Check it out. Hopefully you like what you see. And feel free to give us feedback. There is a way to submit comments and questions right there on the website. And then lastly, I hate to end with a little bit of a sad note, but if you follow us again on social media, you probably saw that our episode 108 guest on the P-38, and that was with Boat, Mr. Marshall Hanna, passed away in June, just a couple months from his 101st birthday. Obviously, our condolences to his family. Boy, what a life and what a great story that gentleman had on that episode with Boat, talking about flying the P-38 and the bombing site and being a prisoner of war. And yeah, we hate to see him go, but that is, I think, the nature of that generation. And we're trying to catch as many of them as we can before. All right, a couple listener questions. This one is from Janik, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, who says, I recently listened to FPP 165. How military forces help and heal. And what caught my attention is the part that some of the helicopters had to be moved from Bahrain quickly to Sumatra for the humanitarian assistance and disaster relief effort. My question is, how are the aircraft moved so quickly? Is it by air, like we see in pictures of a C-5 Galaxy nose opening with helicopters inside? Or is it on ships, kind of like how escort carriers carried planes to and from places in World War II? Well, Janik, I don't think we generally send a whole lot of aircraft via the Air Force. We can if necessary, but that's not typically the way we do it. But I wasn't entirely sure, so I asked our guest, Alan Worthy, from that episode, and he confirmed my suspicions, which is the USS Essex happened to be in the Arabian or Persian Gulf, however you refer to it, and it pulled pierside in Bahrain and loaded up the CH-53s, or MH-53s, I guess maybe it was. At any rate, I think to the last point of your question, Janik, we don't necessarily have escort carriers and different types of carriers these days like we had in World War II, but we can load extra aircraft on if the ship is making a transpac or translant and we need to get some there or back. So there you go. All right, next question is from Samuel. I am in the process of applying to the U.S. Air Force and Navy for a pilot slot. I understand operational tempos always depend on airframe, mission, current world situation for both services. And I'm wondering if in the Navy, as things simmer down in the Middle East, the amount of and length of deployments is changing for carrier-based aviators. Maybe a more general version of the question might be, how does carrier aviation life change as the political world shifts? Well, so for everyone else, you should know that I emailed Samuel and basically said, hey, look, dude, if you are worried about op tempo, you're probably joining with the wrong motivations. You join to serve and you join for the opportunity to fly and you stick around usually for the people. But that being said, I might have read too much into his question, and his point is a valid one. And Samuel, there's just no way to know, right? I mean, the world situation is going to change. Nobody knows how it will change or what might be necessary. If peace breaks out all over, then yeah, we could go back to every couple of years, a 6-month deployment just for the sake of being out there. But if things in the South China Sea heat up, then you could go out there for 8-10 months or more. I don't think that should be the reason why you choose the Navy or the Air Force. I think you should try to identify with the service that best resonates with you. Talk to people from both, see what makes the most sense to you, and go and give it your all and just accept the fact that once you commit yourself to a cause bigger than you, you are just a cog in that cause. And so they will use you as they see fit, even possibly sending you in wave after wave until someone gets ashore, like on June 6, 1944. So that comes with the territory. And I think you need to be ready for that when you or anyone signs up to serve in the military. All right, last question is from Stu, who's from the UK. He says, do you get a say in which squadron you are posted to, or even which coast you will get posted to after flight training? Or is that completely down to the needs of the Navy? I seem to recall you saying you could state your preferred aircraft type depending on performance in flight school, but do you get any further input beyond this? Well, Stu, I only have my one experience to base it on, and it's 20 plus years old by now. And when I was a student at VMFAT 101 in El Toro, which is now closed and long gone, and that is a Marine squadron, but I was a Navy student. Towards the end of my FRS training, I submitted I think at that time, it was just a very casual, hey, just email the big XO and tell him what you want. And so I put down F-18s Lemoore, F-18s Japan, F-18s Cecil, and I didn't even need to say F-18s because that's what I had just flown in the FRS. And I got my first choice, if you hold it upside down, Cecil. And at the time, I didn't really go in knocking on the door. Hey, what the heck? They have openings here and there. They do their best. Some of it could be performance. I don't know. I think I finished reasonably well. You just kind of take what comes. Now, you didn't specifically ask this, but I'll answer it anyway. As you get more and more senior in your Navy career, you can talk to what's called the detailer in the Navy. I think in the Marine Corps, they call it the monitor, and I don't know what the Air Force calls it. But at any rate, there's a person like me. I could have gone and done this, but I didn't. But again, if you listen to the Crozier episode, you might have heard him say that he did that. He went to Millington, Tennessee, and was the detailer for young helicopter pilots. And you can ask them, hey, what have you got? Or this is what I want to do. What do you think? And there's different ways they can work with you. They can either delay your timing, perhaps. Hey, if you leave a little later, we have a job where you're hoping. Or if you leave a little sooner. Or they just tell you, hey, look, this is what we have. Take your best pick, take it or leave it kind of thing. But yeah, it might be different these days coming out of flight school or the FRS. But my guess is you put in your dream sheet and the Navy says, that's cute. Hold my beer. Here's what you get. And off you go. I hope that helps, Stu. And appreciate everyone's questions for right now. If you have a question for the show, you can send it via social media or you can email us questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com. Our phone number is still on hiatus for right now. We're trying to decide if we miss it or not. If not, we might just retire it for good because right now we're paying a little monthly support fee to keep it kind of in the back burner. But we might bring it back if we do more of these types of audio episodes where I catch you up on what's going on in everyone's lives and answer these questions. All right, well, with that, let's get to the interview. Now, I have to confess something. I have not listened to this one. As I said at the top, it is with a guest co-host, and you might remember our buddy Craig Snyder, call sign Crunch. He was on the show way back talking about surface-to-air missiles, and then he was one of the co-hosts of our sister show, the F-14 Tomcast. And so we had a gentleman from the Italian Air Force, a retired general, who reached out and said, hey, I've got cool stories and would like to come on the show, but I live in Norfolk. And I said, well, I don't know how I'll get out there and make that work. So we put two and two together, and Crunch was willing. So they found a studio and they recorded the interview you're about to hear. There's also the video version on our YouTube channel. So with that, let's both enjoy it together. I will not be back afterwards just because I need to move on to other things, but maybe on the next episode at the beginning, I'll tell you what I thought about it. And always you can email us or leave comments on social media as well. Anyhow, since I won't be back, I want to thank you for listening to the show and for your support all these years. We are midway through our sixth year as a podcast, and I am definitely going to keep it going for another year because, as you Patreon supporters know who get to read a chapter a month, I'm working on my memoirs. And so once the book is ready, I want to keep the show going so I can obviously socialize it that way and use the megaphone of the podcast to keep it going. But no, I do appreciate everybody hanging on with us and listening to our different topics. And with that, let's listen to Crunch talk with General Bellini about flying the Tornado and being a guest of the Iraqis in Desert Storm. Here we go.
Today on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. You may remember me from the F-14 Tomcast as well as being on Jell-O Show previously. And today we have an amazing guest. We are joined today by General Gianmarco Bellini of the Italian Air Force, who lives here in Virginia Beach. He is the Honorary Consul of Italy to the United States. And he is joining us today to tell us some stories. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Greg, for this introduction. You know, I live in Virginia Beach from 2005, actually, with my wife, and we have no children on our own, but we had children that are older and they live away, so we don't have any cats or animals.
No cats?
No cats, no pets or anything. And generally, I do my work as an honorary consul, but I also, like I did all my life, I love to fly, so I fly a lot.
You still fly today?
I still fly. I'm going Friday. I fly to Cincinnati and then starting my trips there back and forth.
And what are you flying?
I fly the Boeing 737.
Oh, so do I.
Audi. And for Atlas Air.
I did not know that.
And it's been almost 5 years that I've been with that company. Before that, I was flying for United Express with Mesa.
Uh-huh.
Flying from a base in Washington, Dallas.
Oh, no kidding.
With this CRJ 700.
Right.
That was a busy, busy period. one year, I made almost 1,000 hours in one year.
Wow. And for those who don't know, 1,000 hours in a year of hard time, that's your limit. You time out.
Yeah, exactly. Wow.
I didn't realize that you were flying for Atlas. I assumed that you were just resting on your laurels as honorary.
No. I love to fly, and I flew as a flying instructor in the Hampton area from Hampton Road Executive, Norfolk, basically. And I flew with this school for about 5 years. So
interesting.
I've always been busy with flying. And it's something that once you start doing, you can never stop.
You just love it.
I just love it. That's it. There's nothing. Money can be an issue, yes, I know, but the passion is the thing that makes you doing stuff like a real pilot.
Well, if you're flying the 737, you are a real, you still have to fly that airplane. Yes. I've flown F-14s, F-18s, T-45s. I've flown the Airbus A320 family and the 737 family. And the 737 is of a transport category airplane. You still have to hand fly that. And sometimes I still land a little hard. Sorry about that.
Every time it happens. You know,
you don't deal with a lot of passenger complaints.
No. I do not. Boxers don't complain, and they're always happy. They don't make an applause after you landed, but it doesn't matter. We can live with that.
Yeah.
And I was always saying that any landing where you don't break anything is a good landing.
All right. So you're still flying today because you love it so much. Let's go in the Wayback Machine. Yeah. So back when you were a young guy, where are you from? Well, let's tell everybody. Obviously, you're from Italy. Where are you from? And how did you find yourself in the Italian Air Force?
Well, my family, nobody in my family went through military or being a pilot or not even thinking about pilots in the military. Nobody did that career in all my family. So I was the only one that during my high school, I start having interest about airplanes more than anything else, you know. So I said, maybe I can try that. And then I sent my application to the Italian Air Force. Main time, because the time was in September. So before that, I joined also the university as a doctor. I wanted to be a doctor because I said, if they don't take me into the academy, I will be doing a doctor. They call me and they start this career, basically. Flew on the basic flight training for the beginning of the academy course. And then at the end of the 3 years, because it lasted 3 years, we have been sent to the United States for pilot training, the advanced pilot training. So okay. I graduated in Laughlin Air Force Base. And after that, there was still a program in the U.S. Air Force. It was called Fighter Leading Training. That was based in Holloman Air Force Base in okay. New Mexico. So they sent me over there for another 6 months. I flew the T-38 Talon with a box of GAN and flying in some of the air-to-air maneuver and air-to-ground training. So it was a lot of fun.
I heard the T-38 I've never flown the T-38.
It's a beautiful airplane to fly, I tell you. And
Afterburning supersonic trainer.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Beautiful airplane. After that, I've been sent to Italy. So graduate and everything and sent back to Italy. Going through the OCU in Tuscany.
OCU, what is that?
It's a school for a transition to another aircraft.
Ah, okay.
So the OCU for the F-104.
Okay.
So I flew the F-104 for 2.5 years, almost 3 years. As a fighter bomber, though. So can you imagine, single engine, pure fighter, small wings, like it doesn't have any wings, basically. It's just a little bit.
It's a big engine.
Yeah, it's only a big engine.
Yeah.
We were flying low level and on a base northeast of Italy, ready to go against the Warsaw Pact during the Cold War, you know, basically.
What year are we talking right now?
We are in the 1983.
Okay.
83, 84. Because I finished the course in 82, so I was sent to the base in northeast of Italy, 82, 83, and beginning of 84. My squadron transitioned to Tornado, so everybody was sent to England in Cottesmore, which is in the Midland of England, close okay. to Leicestershire, that area. Nice place and beautiful training. So we transitioned to Tornado, and basically I flew all my career on that aircraft.
And so that was in mid-80s, you transitioned to Tornado?
Yeah,
84,
January 85, we transitioned to Tornado. And so from 85 to 2002.
That's pretty neat. So yeah. In the Tornado, if memory serves, it was built by a European consortium?
Yeah, it was the British, the Italians, and the Germany. They all built parts of the aircraft and then assembled together. It was a nice airplane. Especially the training part was very interesting because we train all the three nations in the same base in England.
You know, oh, okay.
With an instructor from all three nations, basically. Mm-hmm. So we had everybody coming to Cottesmore. That was the base in England. And they were trained exactly the same way before going back to their own nation, basically. So, and I was instructing there for 3 years.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So now some of our listeners may remember probably 4 years ago, Jello interviewed a guest, I think it was episode 47 about the Tornado. He had somebody on to talk about that. I know that they talked through all the different variants and you were flying. I know there's a fighter bomber, an electronic attack, and it's something else.
Yeah. Basically, the fighter was something that was not really a big success, you know, because it was very difficult to maneuver an airplane that is designed to fly low level. You can really go 30,000 feet.
You cannot? It's a design for a low level bomber. That's it.
It's designed for low level. They made a little bit of changes. Modification of the initial structure of the airplane, but it was not designed to be a fighter. So it was designed to be a fighter bomber. Very low level, very stable platform that was absolutely stable. There were no GPS at that time, but the system was so precise that you can drop a bomb without seeing anything. And
off the inertial navigation system.
From the inertial navigation system.
Wow.
Basically a computer that was taking off all the errors and adjust the errors, and it was a pretty smart.
Wow. So the airplanes I flew, our INS and the Tomcat was, you know, we called that the Driftmaster 2000. It was so bad
We had the same thing with the F-104. We had an inertial navigator in the F-104. Nobody were looking at that because it was way off all the time. So it was impossible.
So you were flying, I believe it's the IDS version. How does that version compare? Forgive me if I say it wrong here, but how does that compare to like the GR1 through GR4? How does that?
There's a lot of difference. For the GR4, for example, I'm not sure because it was mainly a British version of the Tornado. He had a different weaponry, different way to, he had a laser.
Oh, you didn't have a laser.
We did have a laser in the pod, but we couldn't have a they had a laser in the airplane. It was capable of painting anything with a laser from the cockpit, which is not something that we could do except when we had the pod with a bomb on that. But it was not our version was not completed with these things. So,
all right. So that takes us up to the mid-'80s. And then we fast forward 5-6 years and Saddam invades Kuwait. All sorts of stuff happens. That was 1990, right?
Yes.
And then January, I believe it was 18th of 1991, you had a mission. I believe it was January 19th. Is that right? Or was it January 18th?
It was January 18th.
January, the first day.
So the first day was the, I think it was the 16th or the 17th. I think it was the 17th. But we have been put on a ATO, which is the task order, the night after that, because we had some kind of internal issue with the government and all the stuff, you know. But so in the night of the 18th, actually the night from the 17th to the 18th, we did our mission.
And where were you flying out of?
We were flying out of Al Dhafran, which is in the United Arab Emirates, down in the south, because by the time we get to the coalition, all bases were full of aircraft. You know, everybody took the closest place. And so we deploy 8 Tornadoes, then they become 10 in Al Dhafran. Mm-hmm. We train from there with some unit of the F-16 from the U.S., then we had
so this is in the build-up. Yeah. So a couple months before January, you fly over there. Is that right?
Okay. Exactly. We were going there in September 1990. It was already close to the deadline happening in November when the United Nations said, if you don't withdraw within the 15th of January 1991, we will start the operation. We will start use of force, you know. We were there in November, and we trained with the F-16, the United Arab Emirates, and with the tanker. We had a unit of the Air Force tanker.
Which type of tanker? Do you remember?
It was a 707.
Okay, so the KC-135?
KC-135.
With the...
Yes, with the boom.
Yep.
And at the end, because we don't have a capability of... we don't refuel with a boom. We refuel with a probe and a basket.
You know? Like we do in the Navy.
Exactly.
If I may shake your hand, sir, that's the way men do it.
That's the right way to do it, you know? And but it was pretty tough because that little thing, you know, the little piece of tube that you have between the boomer and the basket is very unstable. So you have to make the loop and keep it in a certain way. I mean, it's tough.
It is tough. I have done, I could do a story time and talk about the first time I tanked on a KC-135 was my first day in the fleet in VF-32. And I remember to this day because Trigger Kelly was my flight lead and Pink Floyd was his Rio. He was the skipper. And he looks at me and says, "Hey, new guy, don't F it up." Right. That was his wisdom to me that day as we were going out to hit the tanker and the KC-135. And it's that thing. It's got that basket. You put your probe out. And as you move up, if you go too slow, your bow wave, the pressure wave moves it away. and then it moves around, and then you hit it.
And then you hit it, and then you hit it in one side, so you have to come back and do it again. Yeah, at the end, we were pretty in good shape with that. You know, we trained a lot, and it was okay. And then the 15th of January, the war started. Nobody was thinking about that. I was in my room, a small room, with a navigator that was in the square. And we were thinking, how can it happen, these things? You know, how can be a war in this century? I mean, it's unbelievable. And we thought that we were preparing for another big thing that would never happen, which was our hope also. But it was not like that. I mean, everything started the 15th. The night over there, the F-16 start moving from there, and then the night after, we start ourselves, you know, in that mission.
And so you go on, you launch out of Al Dhafra.
Al Dhafra, yes.
Hit a tanker over Saudi Arabia.
No, it was over the sea, which was not a good idea because the range was between 15,000 to 21,000, something like
pretty
that.
Pretty low, actually.
Pretty low.
Yeah.
And the turbulence at that point was so big, we couldn't get through. Our flight was not able to refuel. And
because the basket was
moving
around.
Because the basket was crazy, and we tried to get there. Actually, my leader made it, but he couldn't get any fuel because he broke his probe before that, you know, when he tried. Yeah. Because we give ourselves every 15 minutes time to get to close to the tanker and then trying to connect to get fuel. If you busted those 10 minutes, you move away and you have the other one trying to get. Otherwise, we couldn't make anyone.
You basically had to give yourself a chance and then let somebody else try.
And then somebody else is trying. So when it was my turn, I made it. I don't know why. I just made it. And I got all my 3,000, almost 4,000 kilograms of fuel. And I move away. So I wait for my leader to get and try to. So he did, and he couldn't refuel because the probe was broken. So at that point, I decided to continue because the mission was at night, low level. There was no visual protection because at night there's not much you can protect, you know, especially in the desert there. But I was confident that all the protection, the electronic protection, was in place, which was not, because nobody could refuel at that period, you know.
So you were supposed to have electronic suppression of enemy air defenses.
I supposed to have. I was expecting somebody that was all the electronic protection and all the they were there, but they were not. And when I start my run to the target, actually before that, when I start descending over the sea, I called the AWACS, the coordinator there, and I called him twice, two or three times, because he didn't answer. And I told him, hey, this is Legion 14, which was my call sign. I'm going inbound, and I'm continuing the mission. And he said, Roger. So for me, that was the okay to proceed, you know, and there was no other strange situation going on, so I said, I'm going to go. I'm going to have all my protection and everything, and nobody's going to. And it was not that case. Everybody was concentrating on my aircraft.
There was nobody else flying, so it was all the guns were pointing at you.
And in fact, approaching the coast of Kuwait, because our target was in Kuwait, it was between close to the border with Iraq. And there was a deposit of ammunition that was kept by the Iraqi, of course. And so we had to manage to hit that target, you know. And approaching the coast of Kuwait, the AAA start to blow all over the place, you know. And I said, oh, well, look, this poor guy is going to be... they are hitting him for sure, you know, this poor guy.
Because it's all over there.
They were all shooting at me, and that was something interesting. We were going at 550 knots at 100
feet at night.
At night, yes.
And you didn't have night vision goggles at that time.
No, we had the terrain following, which is a system that built was basically Tornado was built on the terrain following. And you could get the aircraft down to 200 feet, 200 feet at 0.9 Mach, and the aircraft was doing everything by itself. You don't have to touch it. The other thing, you can go lower if you disconnect the autopilot and use the radar returns that you have on your side as a map return. The system is designed to find any type of obstacle, you know, on the ground. So, and you, if you maintain this line within, you can go down to 100 feet. So that's what we did.
That's what you did.
That's what we
did. At 550 knots.
At 550 knots. Yeah.
That's impressive.
That was fast.
Very fast. At night.
So we dropped the bomb. And with the bomb, I order also, I ask my navigator to drop also the tanks, because the tanks were almost empty, the external tanks. So I can get more maneuverability. And when he dropped the tanks, the aircraft gained a little bit of altitude. So I start descending again, and he was giving me all the altitude from the terrain and thing. And when we get basically wings level, going toward the sea again, trying to go back to the tanker and go back to Al Dhafra, AAA hit my aileron, one of my aileron, the right one. And it took almost 40% out of the aileron. The aileron is like an aileron for a normal airplane, but we use the aileron as an elevator and as an aileron as well. That's the way the Tornado is designed. Aileron, yeah. And it took one of these. Maneuverability was impossible at that point. The aircraft started to roll. It rolled the first time completely. I tried to contrast it using the cloche, the maneuver, you know, and trying to contrast them. Nothing changed in the speed of turning. So when we returned back, I ordered the ejection. I pulled the handle. My navigator goes first because the sequence is done in that way. And then I went off the airplane. The airplane is crashing less than a second.
Because you're at 100, less than 100 feet probably
at
this point.
When we pulled the handle, we were at 30 feet.
30 feet. Wow. Okay. So that's like a second story building.
Yes. And all this data came out from the crash recorder, which was recovered by a crew of British that swept all the area after the war to collect all the remaining of their tornado, because they lost seven tornadoes, one on every night, for 7 nights. And then they started doing some high-level, medium-level bombing, which was then safe because we didn't have any problem there. So they found part of the wreckage of my airplane. They collected the crash recorder, gave it to our authorities in the Air Force. And from there, they study all the data of the crash and everything. That's why I know about
that's
the 30
you know,
feet.
30 feet.
And the speed and all the other stuff.
Wow, that's impressive. Because otherwise you'd be like, I have no idea. It's
I have
dark
no
out.
Idea, yeah. It was dark.
So we found the crash, or the British.
The British, they found the crash. They make a picture. I got all the pictures. Everything, the two engines, the airplane crash, very close to the command post of this AAA, probably. Was not probably the one that kills us, but probably one of those. So they found part of my equipment also in this command post. Part
stuff of my, they had retrieved.
So they probably captured us, kept us into that command post for a while. They took all our stuff and they gave us the yellow jacket for POW, you know, the one that has been seen during that period.
So now you ejected, you landed. Were you conscious?
No, okay. I don't remember.
You don't remember?
I don't remember. The thing I probably, because the first, my navigator went out from the cockpit with 16 degrees of bank, and I left the cockpit at 47 degrees of bank. So it was very close to 90 degrees of bank, which is probably at that time I would probably be crushed into the sand.
Unsurvivable.
Unsurvivable.
Right.
So I was very, very lucky on that. We landed. I don't remember the first 4 or 5 days.
Wow.
Yeah. There is something coming up sometimes, especially when I feel some smell, strange smell from the in the air. That's when it remembers me something.
From those but 4 or 5 days, you'll suddenly have a memory.
Some kind of memories, but nothing.
Really? Is it like some food or a
maybe the smell. Must? The smell was the thing that really kept me wondering. It probably is connected to something that happens that period.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
So for 4 or 5 days, I don't know. There's some I could reconstruct some of the time because with me actually for 2 or 3 days there was a Kuwaiti pilot on the A4 that was shut down the same night after me, and we spent some time together. So he was talking to me and say, "Hey, I remember you. You were there at that time in that cell." That you were calling for somebody to give you some kind of water or things, you know, and I reconstruct some of the stuff, but I couldn't I don't really remember that period completely. Then after that, I remember everything, every single moment.
So somewhere around the 4 or 5 days.
After the 4 or 5 days, in main time in that period, we were traveling. They brought us from Kuwait to Basra.
Basra is down in the southern part of Iraq. South. Yeah.
Then from Basra to Baghdad, and we stopped at one of the army base. Basically, with this guy told me that we were kept into this NCO officers club, NCO club of the Iraqi, and we were questioned and interrogated during that period, which I was not in a very good health for that time because I was not conscious. So
this is in the first 4 or 5 days. You're being interrogated. You don't remember that?
I don't remember that. No.
Wow. I assume it was harsh interrogation.
I think so, because always Mohammed Mubarak, the guy that the pilot that was Kuwaiti pilot, he told me that we were beating quite a lot during that period. So then after that, they took us to Baghdad, and we stayed in Baghdad for almost all the time. In this big building, which was a building of the Republican Guard, and underneath, on the bottom, probably a couple of floor below that, there were prisons. So the prisons were basically into the ground, and we had only a small window that was looking at the... And you could see from the window there was... we were at the base of the ground, basically, so we were underneath the ground for most of the time. We stayed there until the 23rd of February. The building was hit by as a target, basically, and it was completely destroyed.
With you in it?
With us in it, because we were more than 20, 25 probably at that point. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, the fact that it was underground, we didn't have anybody killed. In that maybe
so the whole building's coming down over top of you, but you were okay
all
in
over
the basement
the place, and we stay in the basement. There was and we survived, and then after that they brought us in 3 or 4 different prisons for a few days.
They just kept moving you around?
Kept moving us, and then they freed us on the 3rd of March.
So let's back that up. So when that building was hit as a target, do you think it had anything to do with the fact that you all were there?
Or no.
They probably had no idea, otherwise they wouldn't have hit it.
No idea.
Okay. And then they moved you around to different places. Was this the Republican Guard that had you, or was this regular army? What?
I think the Republican Guard, because they were interrogating us all the time. And it was not an easy interrogation at that time, you know, and they were beating us and interrogating us. So
pretty brutal, pretty straightforward.
Yeah,
they would just beat you with a rifle or something.
They were tough, especially because the convention, the Geneva Convention and other thing, they protect the prisoner of war, you know. Mm-hmm. And they require that the entity that keeps them should give to the other part information about condition. My family never know if I was alive or not.
They never communicated to
absolutely
the Red Cross or anything?
Nothing.
Is how it's normally done.
Is normally what should be done as a Geneva Convention, which is, doesn't matter if you are, didn't sign for this convention. It's a law.
They just chose not to listen.
So, and they told us also. They told me clearly, we are a third world country and we don't apply the Geneva Convention. They told me.
Were they communicating with you in Italian?
No, in English.
In English?
In English,
okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Everybody, there was only at the beginning, they had some pilots interrogating us. And, you know, Italy had for a few years Iraqi pilots in our Air Force, in our Air Force Academy, you know. So they were trained there. Then they did also some basic flight, and then they were sent back to Iraqi. But that was my period of academies, 1977, 78, so 20 years ago, 30 years before that. So
you didn't know these?
No, absolutely.
Okay.
And they were speaking a little bit of Italian, but not as good.
It had been a while for them. Yeah, they didn't remember.
Yeah, it was easier for me to speak English with them than Italian. Yeah.
I gotcha. Oh, wow. So what were they? They were interrogating you. What were they asking you?
They were asking, I think it was more of a psychological thing, you know. They were keeping you under pressure all the time. Because the thing that they asked me was something that you could find in any piece of paper or anything that you look at.
Like a Jane's encyclopedia.
Like a Jane's or anything, or even Google. Well, at that time, there was not Google.
We had Jane's back then.
Yeah, but with Jane's, there was something that you could really get all the information about that. So they were asking very simple thing. And I didn't feel that I didn't have to say anything, you know, because the thing that they asked me was such a basic stuff that, you know, you can really miss that or...
So they were just keeping you under the thumb. There really was no thumb.
They were doing that every 2 days, 1 day, depends.
That's a lot.
And yeah, it is a lot. And the atmosphere was really, really scary because, you know, they brought you in a dark place where this lamp was the only thing that... And this guy that is interrogating you is almost outside your view. You can really see it. And sometimes you have somebody that is going to punch you a fist in your head or, you know, it was really tough.
I'm sure you thought, this is it, I'm not going to make it. Did you ever get to that point?
Oh, yeah, many times, especially after the 23rd of February, after they bombed the prison and they moved us. I said, I'm not going to make it. This is too much for me. And I remember we stay 7 or 8 hours outside in front of a big wall, you know, and I was sitting on my knee, basically, you know, and 7 hours, 7, 8 hours there. It's unbelievable. I mean, I couldn't even move after that, you know, and I said, oh, this is too much.
I assume it was all pilots that were with you?
Yes, most of them, yes.
Did any of them not make it?
We had, I don't think, the prisoner of war, they all made it, because there was one that ejected from the F-18. Yeah, I think, what was the name? The U.S. Embassy called me to see if I had any information about him. Slaughter, maybe? No, But anyway, he's the guy that ejected, and they found after the war, after probably a few years ago, they found some remaining of his body, so he was killed or he didn't make it.
But he wasn't held with
us. He wasn't held with us, and they told the embassy that I never had anybody talking about this guy, or because they, I mean, the beginning was that they were not sure if they kept this under, you know, in captivity, like happened during the Vietnam War or other things, you know. But I told him I never had anybody talking about him or.
So I assume we're talking about Scott Spiker.
Yes. Now I remember his name. Yeah, and they.
So no indications. There was no bombshell here today. Right?
Nobody was even among the prisoner war. There was nobody mentioning that at all. I mean, and also the guards. They nobody ever say that name.
Were there any other cohorts of pilots anywhere? Or you the only? If you were shot down over Iraq, you were in your group. Is that right?
Yeah, we were all together, except that we had a few, I think, Kuwaiti, but they were not pilots. They were in the same prison with us after they moved us a lot toward the end of the war. They were kept in a different floor, so I think it was above us. And there were some families there. There were some women, and we had some children too. So there was probably a different thing, but...
So now, what led them to release you on March 3rd?
The end of the war.
Because that was the day, huh?
That was the day, because when they discussed the ceasefire just outside the border between Kuwait and Iraq, you know the tent? There was a tent, there was Schwarzkopf, and all the big general... A Kuwaiti general, there was also an Italian general, a few other people there. They discussed that and they said part of the ceasefire thing was that they need to release all the POWs. And that was the 3rd of March, I think, or the 2nd, I'm not sure.
How would they know who was there, though, if they hadn't been sharing the information?
One of the generals took a list of names. And he showed a list of names, and there was...
These people back.
And then there was also my name there. So the Italian general that was there phoned to the chief of staff in Italy, Italian Air Force chief of staff. And that guy called my family and told them he's alive. And it was almost on the same time when... Some of the journalists from the major TV because in Italy it was a completely crazy stuff, you know. Everybody were all over my family and trying to get information, and especially the media, the big media, you know. So one of these journalists was in my house when my father took the phone. So he was a big thing. I mean, yeah. Jesus. So this journalist was very lucky because he made a. The announcement in almost direct time. I mean, it's exactly on the same time.
Now, your navigator, was he with you as well?
I never saw him in captivity.
He was the same location, but you didn't see him.
He was kept in another prison or other thing, and he left for Jordan, for the Amman in Jordan, by car the day before the 2nd. So... The ceasefire was the 1st of March, I think it was, when they signed it. So the 2nd, Maurizio went by car to Amman, and he was handed over to the Italian authority there, together with other prisoners, three or four. And the next day, they took us to the airport in Baghdad, and we flew on a Swissair, Red Cross, DC-9, I think it was, or something very old, and we landed directly to Bahrain.
Wow, okay, and then you were repatriated, and
yeah, I spent almost 2 days in the Navy hospital at the Mercy, the ship basically, you know, and it was a great
USNS Mercy, right?
Yes, and we've been there for 2 days. They treat us like one of them, you know, and it was very good. It was, my cholesterol was very, very low. So I had,
I made it. Because you'd been fasting for 6 weeks.
Yes. My cholesterol was so down. Imagine.
Small victories.
Small victories on that.
So now, did your family come to Bahrain to meet you there, or
no,
did you go home?
No, I went to Rome. From Bahrain, we flew on the C-141 to, we landed to Riyadh. And then from Riyadh to Bahrain, C-141. And in Bahrain, we went to the naval hospital.
In Bahrain.
Mm-hmm. We stayed in Bahrain two nights, I think it was. Then the next day from Bahrain to Rome, the Air Force brought up executive jet, something like that.
Something nice.
I had a lot of drinks.
That's great. Yeah. Well, and then you're home, and that's great.
Then it was home.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And so, okay, and then you obviously got back to flying. How long did that take?
I'll tell you, when I get home, the first thing I went to do a physical exam for the Air Force. And they sent me home and said, you're going to have a month of decompression with your family. Don't go somewhere where they don't bother you. And so I picked up and went to the Alps and stayed in the middle of the mountain. And it was nice. After that month, I went to do my physical. And they gave me 30 days of rest, basically. So I got another 30 days of rest. And then after that, they gave me the authorization to fly with another pilot for a month. Mm-hmm. And I was a flying instructor. So my pilot, my student, were all military pilots doing the transition to Tornado. So I was still doing my job, basically. So I started to do my job again without any problem. So it took me 2 months, yeah. And it was amazing because when I started, I mean, my first flight with another instructor, you know, I said, damn, I haven't been to a simulator or anything. So I fly directly from, so I said, I need a lot of help here, you know. And so I took my checklist, I prepared myself, and then I sit down, strap in, then start the APU, and then everything started. Hands were moving like they never stopped. So,
right.
And it was amazing.
You're just right back in.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. It was back to business again. And I did this, my navigator did his first flight with me.
So, ah, excellent.
Yeah, so.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Did you have any other significant combat missions?
No. That's the only one I have.
You talked about flying with F-16s. Do you ever do any other advanced training with other forces, any other countries, any others with the United States, anything else other than that? Time UAE?
Just the time for my pilot training, basically. I did Laughlin and all in U.S.
We kind of talked about this a little ahead of time, so but pretend for the viewers that we haven't. But you're the honorary consul of Italy to the United States. Tell us what that means.
I am basically doing the function of consulate in the area of Virginia, in the area of North Carolina, South Carolina, all that place, you know. And so I have a lot of customers, which are Italian citizens, living in the area that are coming to my office to renew the passport or other things, you know.
So if I'm an Italian in the East area, yes, of the United States, and I go, I have a problem where normally I would go to the embassy in D.C. would be my only choice. Instead, I can call you, and you might be able to help me.
That's what's happened most of the time.
Interesting. Okay, I didn't know that.
Most of the time, yeah. And I do that on my free time because it's a honorary consul, so I don't receive any pay from...
it's a volunteer job.
It's a volunteer job.
Wow, okay. Yeah.
And I love to do it, I mean, because I realize that some of the people that are moved in the United States maybe 30 years ago, they still have a lot of contact or connection to Italy still, you know, in place. But it's more and more difficult when time goes by to keep these things going, especially if the bureaucracy is changing or things are changing. So they, you know, and I like to do it. I mean, it's something that for the time when I be able to do it is a good thing.
It's rewarding to help people.
I feel very good, actually. Yeah. Yes.
And then you go fly airplanes to make
and
a living.
And then fly airplanes. Yes.
What's not to love?
Oh, that's a perfect life, right?
It is. That's a perfect life.
What else can you expect? Yeah.
That's right. So speaking of being a pilot, some of our listeners are aspiring pilots. Maybe they want to go into, maybe they want to be a fighter pilot. Maybe they want to be an airline pilot. Do you have any advice for our young listeners who are thinking about being pilots? Or
yeah, I mean, it's something that you need to pursue with a lot of confidence, but also with a lot of work. It's not something that you gonna have it like this just because you pay. You have to be very prepared in your everything, and this is the best job ever. There is no other job like this, but you need to love it. I mean, if you don't, it's gonna be like any other stuff.
It can be a grind.
It can be very, very boring and very, very bad also.
It's certainly true that there are times where you're just flying from here to there and you're staring out the window for about 3 hours, and you have to be okay with that.
Absolutely.
Because it's actually better than the alternative, which is there's a firelight and you're trying to figure out what
to do. What to do, exactly. So. Or, you know, especially if you have a passenger on board, I mean, you are responsible for the life of all these guys, you know, and you don't want to play games or be stupid. You got to be smart, because otherwise you risk the life of everybody and yours as well. So work hard and just love your flight.
We have several Patreon listeners. So Patreon is, folks who pay a little extra money for some special access. So we have several Patreon listener questions. Looks like four of them have to do with your time as a guest of the Iraqi government, and another six that have more to do with the Italian Air Force and the flying the Tornado. So let's start with the ones about captivity, just because that's a little bit, we'll just start with that. So the first one is from Jim Gundog, and his question is this: what was the one drink or food item you first requested when you were repatriated, and was it the best thing you ever had?
It was a soup of lentils that they gave us the day before they freed us. It was so good that when I came back, I said, I have to have it. And somebody did it for me, and they prepared this soup. Fantastic.
Oh, wow.
Fantastic soup of lentils.
Interesting. We have two questions that are very similar, so I'm going to group these together. The first is from Sven Weber. He says, did you receive any training for the possibility of becoming a POW? And if so, how tough was it compared to the real thing? And the rhyming question is from Nick Brown. And Nick asks, what kind of training did you receive to survive capture? And does the Italian military have something similar to SEER? So basically, what kind of training did you have for being a...
We had some training, but it was, remember, we were still in the Cold War era, right? So our training to survive something like that happens, but the environment was completely different. So we had to survive in a jungle, or not jungle, but in an area where you have houses, you have woods and places where you can hide. And you can get some kind of food over there too. Right. So we had this kind of training, which was designed for the mission that we were doing most of the time. But specifically for a desert or for a situation like the one we had in Iraq, we did not have any training.
There's only so much you can do to simulate that.
Absolutely.
I know that the SEER training I went through, SEER is S-E-R-E, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape training.
That's what we did too. I mean, exactly the same thing, but it was designed for a Cold War environment.
It was designed to be captured by the Soviets,
yes,
essentially.
Exactly.
Right?
Or try to escape the Soviets in a region that it was on the other side of...
And I think the assumption is also that if you were captured by the Soviets or the Warsaw Pact, that they would honor the Geneva Convention. And Iraq just...
It was not the same thing. Yeah. It was not... So we had to improvise and do whatever. But we didn't have any chance. I mean, it was something that we ejected and probably, I don't have a real assumption for that, but probably we were captured immediately because everything was there. They were waiting for us.
Probably took them less than half an hour to get you, and there's a good chance that you were beaten at that point because they, you know, like you were bombing our people. And I mean, you're actually kind of lucky that not only did you survive the ejection, but you survived the capture.
That's what I keep saying. You know, we were lucky to. I was born three times, you know, because one was my actual one. The other one was when I ejected, that we didn't crash into the. The other one, that the bomb on the 23rd of February didn't kill us. So very lucky, very lucky.
And this, I know we've talked about this a little bit, but Michael Tenish asks, as a prisoner of war, did you have contact with other prisoners? And what was the moral effect or morale effect on you?
Well, we talk toward the end. We've been on confined cells for most of the time until they bombed the major, the one that I was talking about, the 23rd of February. After that, they had to share the same facility with the more prisoner of war. They couldn't put us in the same, in a different cell.
They put you in like
They put us in a 4 or 5 prisoner of war in the same cell, and so they would keep. And we were talking about, and most of the time the moral was not bad. Actually, we were thinking it's gonna end pretty soon because the Kuwaiti was listening the radio, and there was some announcement from this radio in Arabic, which. You know, he could understand.
He can't understand, but
we could. So he was actually translating to us. Mm-hmm. And most of them were something that Saddam is the greatest, or some of this bullshit, you know, that they were transmitting. But some of them were, if you were listening carefully, he said that you can see that they are almost at the end of resistance, and that they probably won't be able to keep it for a long time. So we were pretty confident.
So it was great to have him around.
Yeah. So we were confident that he would have ended pretty soon, which he did.
All right. So let's talk about airplanes. So Joe Kunzler, his question is, so what targets did you go after in Operation Desert Storm?
The target was an ammunition deposit that was held by the Iraqi after they invaded the Kuwait. But it was actually...
It was in Kuwait.
Yeah. Yes, at the border with Iraq.
Gotcha. So was it actually Kuwaiti munitions that they had acquired, or they were
think,
just using?
I don't
it?
Think so. They're using it and to keep all the stuff, but it was part of our task.
What else was in that target package?
There was another station of transmission that was kept by the Iraqis, so we were trying to get rid of those. But the only target that was hit in Kuwait was my target.
George Queso Bravo, his question is this. Were there many differences between the Italian Tornado IDS, the German IDS, or the British GR1 through GR4? So I think we actually talked about that.
We talked about that. But basically the German and the Italian, they were pretty much the same structure, same type of capability. GR4 is different. We talk about the laser system that was built in the airplane. They had also the outside, they had a electronic warfare of the wing, the outside, the last building. It's a building pod, but it was changeable. So they could take it out and bring something else on it. The IDS, German and Italian, the electronic warfare was inside the airplane, so we had it mounted in the airplane, so it was not in a pod, basically. Then there are a few other differences.
All right. Niels Hansen, he asks, how much training prior to Desert Storm did you conduct with coalition partners in order to increase effectiveness and reduce potential mishaps? So you're talking about interoperability with other foreign governments. So you talked about with the U.S. Air Force. Who else were you working with before?
We did a lot with German, with the French, we did British a lot. In 1990, we've been through the red flag in Nellis Air Force Base. So we were basically pretty well trained to to deal with a big coalition type of operation, you know. Because the red flag, you probably remember hundreds of airplanes taking off in the same time, you know. And then you had to deconflict all these things and be able to. Interoperability was one of the major thing, and we were pretty good in that, I think.
Anthony Lombardo, his question: how many hours were Italian flight crews accruing during Desert Storm? I don't know if you even know that, because you weren't flying. How about everybody who was still flying? How much were they flying? A lot?
I think they did 12 of 13 sorties like that, or even more that. I'm not sure.
So roughly 6 weeks, dozen
from,
sorties
from the
18th
of January to the 29th of February, basically, because then they stop all the operation there for the ground. The ground operation, you remember, is 100 hours probably.
So you're not flying a mission every day, or maybe even every other day, maybe every third day?
Every 2 days, probably, or every 1 day. So you come back, rest 1 day, and then the next day you prepare for the next one.
It's quite a bit.
It is a lot, yeah.
Michael Durcock, he asks, have you ever flown on Allied Forces exercises with the Slovak Air Force?
No, never happened. But I remember in England, when I was a flying instructor there, we were having some kind of operation with Russia, because, you know, there was a program for NATO to have Russia into the NATO preparation or something. And it was a partnership for NATO. It was not really part of NATO, but partnership for NATO. And we had a few crews that were coming to England, then landed there and wait, and then go to the officers' club and get a beer, and then we were discussing that. And I remember one of those was a Hungarian crew, and we were talking that they were preparing to bomb our base in northeast Italy, where I was from, and we were preparing to hit their base in near the Balaton Lake, you know, and that was amazing. And so we were discussing that. We couldn't even think of when we were preparing for this, that one day we would be talking at the bar together.
And yeah, that's amazing.
That's amazing.
Great. It really is.
It was a nice period then.
Yeah. All right. Last listener question from Patreon from Scott Kelly. Scott asks, did the Italian Air Force also employ the Tornado at extreme low level like the Brits? Which, of course, yes. We did, yes. And the question is why?
Because the aircraft was designed and its best performance was low level. We were training in Canada to go down to 100 feet in the Labrador area, and is really impressive.
Yeah. Really, and like impressive. You said, it's designed for it. It's got terrain following radar, yes. And that's what it does.
And that's a stable platform. You can count on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. Well, it has been, we've got all the questions here. This is great. So, General, this has been an amazing conversation. I really appreciate the time you spent with us today. I feel I have learned a lot, and I hope I've made a friend.
Oh, absolutely.
Because since we are here in the same town.
Absolutely.
And we fly the same airplane now the weekends. Yeah. For our listeners, are you active on social media by chance?
Yes, I'm on the Facebook. You can go and Google my name. It's probably you'll find me. And what else?
Are you on Instagram or no?
I'm
TikTok?
Not,
do you do dance videos on TikTok?
No,
you don't?
No. No, I think only the Facebook is the only one that I'm using.
Great.
Once in a while.
I'll make sure to find you on there and
okay.
I'll add you on the way home.
Absolutely.
It'll be perfect.
Absolutely.
Not while I'm driving. I'll do that.
No.
Oh, great. Oh, and we talked about it a little bit that there's a film that you were interviewed on, and you talked through a lot of this. I saw a snippet of it a little bit. Where would folks go to see that full-length feature? Documentary? Interview? Whatever it is.
It's probably Veterans of Gulf War, something like that.
Well, maybe we could find that, and we could put it in. We'll put that in the link, or in the notes down below. We'll figure that out.
I'm going to send it to you, and because the owner of the film, he said that he's not against it, so be happy to do it.
Excellent. So one of the last things we do here on the show is we always like to talk about call sign stories. So you have a call sign? And it is...
It's strange. It's a very unique call sign. They called me from the beginning when I get to the squadron. I was with a big beard.
A beard?
Beard, yeah. Like a mustache beard and a little bit of hair as well. not as many, but a little bit. And they called me Puffo.
Puffo?
Puffo, which means Smurf. So, because, you know,
you look like a Smurf.
Smurf.
Look like Papa Smurf.
And it stays like that for all my career, basically.
Oh, that's so funny. Oh, well, that's great. Well, General, thank you very much.
Thanks
this has been an incredible
me.
Conversation. Thank you for sharing your story with us. I know that it's very interesting to our listeners. I don't know if it was hard for you to talk about or think
absolutely,
about.
Absolutely.
But I think it's really interesting to hear stories about this and to see the success that you've gone to. I mean, you're a retired general, honorary consul, and flying every day still to this day. So. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, actually, and it's been an honor. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet show that explores the fascinating world of air combat. Visit our website, fighterpilotpodcast.com, for a blog, a glossary of the terms used on this show, and a shop page featuring unique military aviation-themed books and apparel. Check out our YouTube channel to watch hundreds of military aviation-themed videos. And for exclusive content, head on over to our Patreon page. Thanks for listening.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.